Christian just says the planet don't have a PhD.
It's fine. There's no fine seating right
now. Size called weird. I'm sure that size called glasses for some reason. I don't even know what that means to me.
Like, yeah, I need to remember.
Okay. All right. Hi, everyone. So welcome to our final RNA Club of the year. We had two awesome speakers from Sunshine Fourth Floor. First, we have Lina Kabani from the Stanford Lab, who is going to be talking about the role of IGF2BP3 in risk target site selection during acute MLL. Lymphoblastic leukemia. So many abbreviations.
Yeah.
Okay. Take it away.
Thank you. Thanks for your introduction. All right. Okay, yeah, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for having me. I would like to start off this talk by saying that this project is a collaborative effort. The IGF2BP3 project is a longstanding project from the Sanford Lab and the lab of Dinesh Rao at UCLA. I didn't find an up-to-date lab picture of the Rao lab, so you get to enjoy Dinesh's selfie. But it's been so great to work with them, and especially UCLA with their more medical background, as you can imagine. It's been a really, really great collaboration so far. So to start off, just a little bit of just a brief overview of the different types of leukemias that you can differentiate. So leukemia, as you all probably all know, is a cancer of the blood, is a disease of the blood. And the main problem with leukemia, as with all the cancers, is that you get an accumulation of progenitor stem cells. And so there are a couple of main kind of categories you can group leukemia into. There is acute and chronic, but then there's also lymphoblastic and myeloid, and they differ in that which branch of the red blood cell, white blood cell lineage they affect. So our focus is on B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia, abbreviated B-ALL. It's a mouthful, so I'm just going to refer to it as B-ALL from now on. And below here, actually, you have a couple of cell lines that are typically used to study these types of cancers. And our lab has actually before also used the REH cell line, but for this project, we mainly use the SCM cell line, which are patient-derived cell lines. So I don't want to bore you with too many statistics, but I think it's still important to mention. So for starters, leukemia is actually the most prevalent form of blood cancer. And in the United States, leukemia accounts for a third of all the childhood cancers. Not only that, but the type we're studying, lymphoblastic leukemia specifically, actually disproportionately affects children. So this is a bar plot showing the distribution of the diagnosed leukemias in children. And this blue bar graph over here shows the amount of lymphoblastic leukemias. And as you can see, this is the biggest one in this proportion. And over here on this side, you have kind of a similar graph showing something similar where you can see how the incidence peaks at more younger ages from young adults and children. So of course, again, I'm not gonna go through all the facts of pediatric cancer, but I think it is very important to mention that leukemia is actually nowadays, it's pretty treatable. The survival rate has gone up quite a bit thanks to modern science. However, there's still some significant problems associated with pediatric cancer in general. For instance, one main issue is that a lot of these children later in life, when they reach adulthood, they will suffer from complications that were related to their treatment because the treatment is quite aggressive. And not only that, but also the research itself is very, very underfunded and therefore relies on humanitarian efforts. And of course, and I don't think I need to tell you this because we have some experts in house that probably know better than me, but pediatric cancer in general also is a bit unique in that it differs from adult cancer. So there is need for treatment still, despite the survival rate being quite high nowadays. Before I dive into the project, I want to talk a little bit about what MLL rearranged leukemia actually is. So MLL is a gene. It stands for mixed lineage leukemia, and it actually encodes for a histone-methyltransferase. So over here, you have an overview. This is the normal MLL gene with the N and C terminus. Annotated, and then this is an example of an MLL fusion, which MLL fusions occur very frequently during leukemias. So normally, MLL is a complex, and so when it is intact, the MLL complex recruits many epigenetic factors and other complexes who then regulate entire gene clusters, such as, for example, the HOXA9 cluster shown here. And as you know, the HOXA9 cluster is very important for development. Now, when these fusions happen, MLL is no longer able to recruit the partners, interaction partners it needs to accurately fulfill its role. So what happens is there's a dysregulation of the clusters it's supposed to regulate. And in the instance, the example for HOXA9 actually, there is an increase in the expression of these genes, which leads to increased proliferation, decreased differentiation, as we all know, these are two hallmarks for cancer. And over here, this is just kind of a depiction of what I just explained. So you can see this is a normal MLL gene with the N and C terminus of the protein and its interaction partners. And as you can see with the aberrant fusion, it no longer recruits the partners it needs. This bar graph over here just shows that AF4 is the most frequent translocation partner of MLL, which is also the translocation we study. Now, the IGF2BP3 project was kind of kickstarted with results from our lab and the Rao lab that I'm showing here. So this is a heat map. I hope it's not. Oh, it's a little bit small. I hope you can still somewhat read it. This is a heat map showing differential gene expression in three different subsets of B-ALL. Over here, you have the MLL rearranged B-ALL. And over here highlighted, you can see a protein called IGF2BP3 that is very highly upregulated in that particular type of leukemia. And not only that, the labs also found that specifically MLLAF4, which I mentioned before, is actually the translocation that makes IGF2BP3 expression which makes it increase the most. So not only is IGF-2BP3 upregulated in MLA-rearranged leukemia, but the translocation itself induces it the most. And over here, you have a CHIP experiment where they pulled down MLA-F4. And as you can see, the gene is in reverse. MLA-F4 actually likes to go to the promoter of IGF-2BP3, thus upregulating it. So not only is it overexpressed in cancerous cells, but it is actively induced by diffusion. Now, what is IGF-2BP3? So IGF-2BP3, which is a really long acronym, so I'm going to call it I3 or IMP3 from now on, depending on how lazy I feel. So the acronym stands for insulin-like growth factor 2 mRNA binding protein 3. It is part of a family, which is made up of protein 1, 2, and 3, and they're pretty conserved all throughout the kingdom. So IGF-2BP3 in particular is actually an oncofetal RBP, meaning that it is required for the development, but it is silenced normally in adult tissue. However, in many different types of cancers, it is reactivated so much so that it's actually a marker, a prognosis for whether you're going to develop cancer or not. So over here is kind of an overview of how IGF-2BP3 functions, and it is actually regulating mRNA expression on the post-transcriptional level at actually different levels in the cell. So it regulates mRNA export, stability, and also transport. It is also an M6A reader, which is another facet of its function. What I'm going to focus on today is how IGF-2BP3 regulates mRNA stability through either repelling or recruiting the RISC complex to its target mRNA. Now, I want to kind of showcase a couple of important experiments that both labs have done that kind of set up the question that I'm actively working on right now. So over to the left, you have a quantification of a FACS sorting experiment. And what you can see is that upon enforced expression of either the human IGF-2BP3 or the mouse IGF-2BP3, doesn't matter which one it is, you have an increased number of hematopoietic stem cells. So again, you get an increase of progenitor cells. And on the right side, you have a survival graph, and this was done using an MLA-F4 mouse model. So the red graph is the mice carrying the translocation, and the orange graph is these same mice, but with IGF-2BP3 deleted, knocked out. And as you can see, the survival of these mice actually increases pretty by a lot. And this is just leukemia-free survival. Over here to the right, you actually have overall survival, which is even higher. So it's pretty impressive if you think about it, because this is a single RNA binding protein that you knock out of a mouse model and the mice starts surviving. So that was a pretty impressive result. Not only that, but the plot thickens quite a bit, because the labs also figured out that IGF-2BP3 binding sites overlap with microRNA binding sites in 3' UTRs of their mRNA targets. So you have a meta-analysis gene plot here. And on the left side, you have two different cell models, REH and RS411. And this was a clip. This was done from an eClip experiment. And as you can see, IGF-2BP3 likes to bind exactly where microRNA binding sites are found. And over to the right side, you can see the same kind of result, except that this was done with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma cells. So this seems to be a consistent pattern, or at least a common pattern, across different cancers. Now, this kind of tied IMP3 to the RNA-induced silencing machinery, and this was a very interesting connection. So the labs explored this a little further. So what you're seeing here are immunoprecipitation experiments. And what was done is that several target genes, including this one, which was a control gene, were pulled down, and then they quantified the AGO2 association on these target transcripts of IGF-2BP3. So again, this is a control, and an HMGA2 is a known oncogene that is also a very well-characterized IMP3 target. So the black bars are the AGO2 association in absence of IMP3. And as you can see, so here there's not much difference for the control gene, but for HMGA2, you can see an increase in AGO2 when IMP3 isn't there, meaning that the consequence of this is that the mRNA expression goes down, which you actually can't see in this graph. And then Over here, for this group of targets, you can see the exact opposite. You can see the AGO2 association decrease upon M3 knockdown, which then has the consequence that the mRNA goes up in its absence. Now, if you kind of look at this result, there's a very interesting pattern that emerges. Namely, that it seems that M3 likes to stabilize oncogenes, and it likes to repress tumor suppressor genes. So it almost seems to have a bimodal mode of action, which was a very interesting result. So this very, very heavily ties risk together with M3, of course. And this is an RNA department, so I guess I don't need to mention this, but of course, as you probably all know, AGO2 in humans is the organoprotein and the risk complex that is the catalytic subunit, meaning it is responsible for the targeting of its mRNA loaded either with a microRNA or an siRNA. The main difference being that the microRNA is an imperfect match to the RNA and the siRNA is a perfect match. Now, what's actually interesting about AGO2, human AGO2, is that AGO2 loaded with its small RNA is actually termed minimal risk, meaning it is self-sufficient. Once it's loaded, it's completely self-sufficient. It can find its target, bind it, and cleave it by itself. And this is kind of depicted in this little schema over here. And there are some preferences in the small RNA, like which end contributes to what. But what I would like you to focus on is actually this very first step over here, the binding, which is actually completely dependent on target accessibility. This means that AGO2 loaded with its small RNA can only bind its target when it's accessible. So if there's a secondary structure, it is unable to bind. Now, with that kind of in mind, and with what I mentioned earlier about AGO2, you can kind of start to think about a couple of scenarios of what that might look like, what the dynamic between M3 and AGO2 might look like. And of course, the easiest model you could think of is this one over here, competition model, where, like I said, because the binding sites overlap with both proteins, you can think about a competition where they both compete for the same microRNA binding site. However, and again, this ties into the whole bimodal mode of action that I mentioned earlier. And also what I mentioned about AGO2 is there could also be maybe an allosteric activation going on or an allosteric inhibition, meaning that M3 either makes the microRNA binding site accessible to risk or shields it from risk. So the question is I3 mediated risk binding allosteric? Is it competitive? What exactly is the mode of action? And to kind of answer that, we kind of employ almost like a two-sided approach. So on one hand, we wanted to do a bit of a more global analysis and analyze the targets of M3 and AGO2. But on the other hand, we also wanted to do some biochemistry to see, to exactly examine what is the kind of binding dynamic between both proteins and their targets. And so just as a very short overview of like kind of the global analysis, the first step for that is we wanted to do what we call a conditional clip assay. And what I mean by conditional clip is that we wanted to look at AGO2 binding either in presence or in absence of M3. And so this is kind of a bit of a workflow of what we call ECLIP, MIR ECLIP more specifically. And this is a modified ECLIP protocol in which not only do you get the AGO2 binding sites, but you actually also get the microRNA that is bound to AGO2 at the time of its binding. And we thought that'd be very valuable for what we're looking at. So the question was, what are the I3 dependent AGO2 interactions? And again, so this is just an overview over the multiple data sets that we have. I have not even nearly enough time to go into the data. And also some of it is very fresh, so we're still kind of digging through it. However, I am gonna just briefly talk about the conditional ECLIP with AGO2. And yeah, again, as mentioned, this was done in SCM cells. So this is just kind of a little bit of QC, if you will. So this is a distribution of the peaks from M3. And we were really happy to see, I only talked about AGO2 here. So I meant to say that I'm going to briefly talk about the conditional eClip, but also the IM3 eClip. Sorry about that. IM3, as you can see here on this little pie chart and the meta-analysis plot, also in this context, seems to prefer 3' UTRs as expected. The vast majority of peaks were found in a 3' UTR, but there was also a sizable portion found in coding sequences. And this was also reflected on the meta-analysis plot over here, which was very nice because, again, we did studies on multiple cell lines, multiple cancer cell lines, and this seems to be a fairly common trend for the protein. And over here now we have AGO2 and two conditions. NT stands for non-targeting. So those are small, because this was done in a CRISPR knockout, so this is either with non-targeting small RNAs or targeting. And the distribution of AGO2 doesn't really differ very much between both conditions. You have the majority of the peaks also going through the 3' UTR, but there's also peaks in other categories, but not much difference between the two. This is also a meta-analysis plot. We have one for both conditions. However, they're so similar, I only put on one. And as you can see, and as expected for AGO2, there is the majority of the binding sites are found in 3' UTRs, which is expected because that's where the microRNA binding sites are. So we were kind of delving into this data a little bit, and we found kind of an interesting pattern. So we compared the AGO2 targets in the knockout and in the non-targeting cells, meaning the cells that overexpress IMP3. And what was interesting is, of course, there was a large portion that was overlapping between the two, meaning they were not affected by the presence or absence of IMP3. However, there was also almost like two categories of targets, namely a category of targets which AGO2 bound to only in presence of IMP3, and a category it bound to only in absence of IMP3. And that was kind of exciting to see because that gave a bit more credence to the whole bimodal mode of action hypothesis that we have. So that was really nice to see. And again, I don't really have the time to talk more about this. And also we just started digging into the data because it's relatively new, but we would like to factor in IMP3 more into this. We'd like to look at shared target size between IMP3 and AGO2. We'd like to look at IMP3 dependent differential AGO2 peaks, for example. So meaning peaks that have different heights, but that are different either in absence or presence of IMP3. It would also be really interesting to see if there are any IMP3 dependent microRNAs perhaps that are bound to AGO2, but we don't know. And of course, as I mentioned, we also have small RNA data, for example, and mRNA-seq. So we would like to also do differential gene expression analysis and microRNA expression analysis. So just quickly moving on now to kind of like the more biochemical side of things. As I mentioned, we wanted to try to do binding assays to get a better idea of what is happening between both proteins and their target. And for that, we decided to start with an EMSA, an electromobility shift assay. So of course, for that, you need a protein and you need a target. And so for the proteins, we decided to use the baculovirus system, which is a system based on insect cells where you infect the insect cells with a virus carrying the protein of your interest. And the advantage to that is that you can massively upscale that actually. So we decided to go with that. And the advantage also is that you get very pure protein as opposed to lysate. Specifically for AGO2, we employed a protocol by the McRae Lab at Scripps Research that allows to not only purify AGO from insect cells, but also to load it with a microRNA of your choice. For the targets, we decided to go with in vitro transcription and radioactive labeling. So as kind of a start, like as a trial run, if you will, we decided to pick HMGA2 as our target, because as I mentioned, this is a very well-known IMP3 target. It's an oncogene. And not only that, it is actually regulated by the microRNA LET7. So because this is a very well-known target, we decided to go with HMGA2 and LET7. And this is kind of a bit of an overview of the different proteins and target versions that we decided to create. So we have two versions of IMP3. One is the wild type. Another one is an RNA binding binding deficient mutant, which does not bind RNA. And then for AGO2, as I mentioned, we decided to load it with LAT7. And for the HMGA2 target, we decided to first start with the wild type, but we do have a LAT7 mutant and an M3 binding site mutant as well. And between this slide and that slide, a lot of time passed. a lot of troubleshooting, a lot of protein expression, but I just wanted to, because I don't have much time, but I still wanted to show you a couple of gels of the successful protein expression. So over here, you have a wild type and mutant M3. As you can see, very nice single band, which was great. And then on the right-hand side, you have some combined gels of a multi-day protocol, which is, as I mentioned, the purification of AGO coupled with the loading of AGO. And without getting into the nitty-gritty of the protocol, what's really nice about these gels is that because of the flow of the protocol, going from here to here, we know that the protein is loaded with the microRNA. Because if it wasn't, it wouldn't even make it past the step. So it was really nice. So we now have AGO2 loaded with the microRNA, and we have purified M3, which was great. So we decided to do a pilot EMSA with M3. And this is what you see here. So again, this was kind of more of a trial run, so I can definitely optimize the protocol. But as you can see, we see a very nice shift for the M3 wild type protein. In the middle, you have a GST tag by itself because the protein is actually tagged. So we wanted to exclude the possibility that the tag contributes to RNA binding. And over here, you have the binding site mutant, the RNA deficient mutant, which has no shift. And so the single shift is most likely one M3 bound to the target, while the higher shift over here is most likely two. So that was really nice. So at least we could confirm the M3 binding to HMGA2. So as we kind of continue to optimize these biochemical assays and continue to dig into the data, we kind of aim to go from this hypothesis that I showed you in the beginning with AGO2 and M3 to actually rigorously testing this post-transcriptional amplifier hypothesis, because you have this RNA binding protein that is induced by a fusion, that is a translocation that is found in these leukemias. And then we can imagine M3 as an RBP kind of amplifying that signal and creating this very, very malignant expression network, repressing tumor suppressors and inducing oncogenes. And so because of this whole bimodal mode of action that I keep mentioning, we can kind of maybe think about two boxes we can put these targets in. And again, this is just speculation. This is just what we think is happening at the moment, what we're trying to test. So we can think of these targets almost as competitive targets and collaborative targets. In the case of competitive targets, which are the targets that M3 likes to induce, we can almost think of a scenario like this, where M3 binds the microRNA, making it hard for RISC to go there and suppress this target. And for the collaborative targets, it'd be the opposite, where it makes it actually accessible to RISC. And so for the binding, our expectation is it'd probably be, for this category, there would probably be an individual association, meaning there's either one or the other. And then for the other category, maybe probably both. And again, if this is allosteric, for this case, we can also imagine something like this, where maybe M3 somehow induces a secondary structure that makes it difficult for RISC to go bind. And here, of course, the opposite, where it opens it up. So with that, I'm already at my summary. So I hope I was able to convince you and show you that we were able to generate a global data set for IGFTPP3-dependent AGO2 RNA targets, that we were able to generate M3-dependent gene expression profiles from these particular SCM cells that I mentioned, that we were able to purify recombinant proteins, including loaded AGO2 with LAT7, and that we establish or are establishing conditions for EMSA assays to test this these binding mechanisms further. And with that, I'm already at my acknowledgements. I would like to thank the lab. I would like to thank Jeremy for having me. I started last September as a postdoc in his lab, and it's been really great. I'm really happy. And I have to say, it's so nice to be part of the collaboration also with the Ryle lab, because I've always wanted to work in human disease. And because I worked in a more obscure model organism before, I felt a little bit removed from that. So it's really nice to kind of get more into this type of topic that very, very much interests me. And of course, again, I want to thank the Ryle lab. I mean, they have been so great to collaborate with, and their expertise has been really, really essential. Then, of course, I would like to thank the Rubin lab, which some members actually came, which is really nice. The Rubin lab has been taking my hand and walking me through the process of protein expression, especially because I had not very much experience with insect cell expression. So all the protein work I showed you today, I actually did in their lab. And especially Seth and Talini also, who's here, who just graduated and, well, graduated, she defended her PhD just recently, has been so helpful and just so nice. And I'm really happy that I was able to learn a lot from them. Then also I would like to thank the McRae lab. They are the ones who developed this AGO2 loading protocol, which has been very, very helpful. And I've been in contact with especially Luca Gerbert, who pioneered this protocol, and he's been very, very helpful and nice in helping me establish this protocol as well. And of course, I'd like to thank our funding sources as well, you for your attention, and also thanks to the department for sponsoring pizza. I think that's really fun. I think it's really great and it brings people together. So thanks also for that.
As far as a first pass of a competitive model, do you know whether the expression of AGO2 and I3 is comparable, or at least within the same order of magnitudes?
Unfortunately, I couldn't tell you. That's kind of the type of stuff we're digging in right now with the mRNA data and everything. Yeah, I would really like to know. This is like the first thing I want to check as soon as we have that data, is what is the relative expressions of these two? Yeah. Oh, sorry. I keep forgetting. I should repeat the questions for Zoom. So the question was if we know already whether the AGO2 expression and the IM3 expression are comparable and what it looks like, but we don't know that yet. Yes.
So these are patient-derived
yes.
cell lines.
Mm-hmm.
Is there also a mouse model?
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking that in pre-prime ETRs, you could do the same thing in a mouse model and get the same genes, and given the pre-prime ETRs should be less concerned, except for like important regulators.
Yes, yes, indeed. So actually the results I showed in the beginning, the survival curve, that was done in an MLA-4 mouse model. And this is in a completely separate paper. They did so many things, but they observed very similar trends in that mouse model as well. Yeah. Also same type of dysregulation of oncogenes and everything. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you have a version of the mRNA that doesn't bind LET7. That makes sense. How do you do that for I3?
Well, I was really lucky because there was a very nice paper that was very helpful for me. And it was a structural paper. And they in a lot of detail, characterized the IM3 binding domains, their binding specificity. And in part of that, kind of, it was a bit more, not very much of a focus, but one of their experiments were luciferase assays. And they had like a CellX experiment where they defined the 100 mer that was a motif. And in that motif of HMGA2, they defined the exact binding site. So I kind of stole these sequences from them just as a proof of principle. But we actually also we intend to use other targets as soon as we get that working. Yeah. Yes. So as far as I remember, the HOXA in general, because it's like multiple genes, it's a developmental cluster. So it's important for, like development and embryogenesis and so on. So as far as I remember, these shouldn't be very active in normal somatic tissue, but they are if this dysregulation happens. So they're like proliferative genes. So this is, I think, part of this proliferation de-differentiation phenotype that we're seeing. Yeah, that's caused by this cluster. Yeah.
There's pizza outside, and let's head back in 10 to 15 minutes. And also, thanks, Lena, again.
Thanks.
Now I'm unmuted. Everyone else, hopefully, is. Oh, let's see. Can I move? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let me find my mouse again. There we go. I know, you're like, get the dust off my pants. Yeah, whenever you are.
Okay, our second talk today is from Chloe Wolliver from the Arbor Lab. And Chloe will be telling us about an unexpected connection between polyamine transporter and mRNA decay. So take it away, Chloe.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. We'll get right into it. So during translation, one thing that can go wrong is when a ribosome stalls and comes to a halt. This can happen at things like rare codons or long polybasic stretches. When this ribosome stalls, this allows time for a trailing ribosome to catch up and collide, which ultimately triggers the start of a quality control pathway called no-go mRNA decay. Now, as the name implies, this pathway results in the degradation of the problematic mRNA. But there's still a lot we don't know about this pathway, so there remain some outstanding questions in the field. For one, what transcripts are targeted by no-go decay? There's no endogenous targets of no-go decay have been identified in animals before. To study no-go decay, we've always used artificial reporters that look nothing like what you would find in the endogenous environment. So while these reporters have been useful to help us study the mechanism of this pathway, they've done little to help us actually identify endogenous targets. Another big question we have is what environmental triggers of no-go decay are there? I mentioned a few triggers of no-go decay, codons and polybasic stretches. However, these are both features of the mRNA itself. Due to the fact that we haven't really found any endogenous targets, this begs the question of whether we're missing out on a third category of targets outside of the mRNA itself. This could be things like disease states or other cellular disruptions of homeostasis. And our third big question is, why is no-go decay important? So because we haven't found endogenous targets, this has left the field uncertain about why this pathway exists in the first place. No-go decay is highly conserved between eukaryotes, so it begs the question of why it's stuck around for so long. This question is also of a special importance because we don't really fully understand the link between this pathway and things like human health and disease. Now, most work to study stalling and no-go decay has been done in yeast and human cells, but our lab is choosing to uniquely use C. elegans to study this pathway. We believe that by using this multicellular in vivo system, we may be able to find unique insight about these pathways that these other systems may have missed out upon. So how are we doing that? Well, the lovely Parisa Monum in our lab developed this rare ARG reporter, or a no-go reporter for us, and it contains a few key features that I want to highlight. First, we have these 12 rare arginines, which act as our stall-inducing sequence. This is combining those two features of stalling that I described before. So rarity of codon, we chose the two rarest arginine codons. And then using 12 arginines counts for a polybasic sequence. So we just want to make a super stall sequence here. And then this is followed up by GFP, which acts as our reporter readout. So how does this reporter actually work? So what we did is you have your ribosomes moving along the mRNA. They come across the stall-inducing sequence and stall, collide, and then one of two things will happen. If no good decay is functional within our system, then the pathway will continue as per usual, resulting in the mRNA decay and giving these really dim GFP negative animals. You can barely even see it in this light, but I swear it's there. In contrast, when we have some aspect of no good decay broken in our system, then instead no good decay won't fully happen and we'll have stabilized mRNA levels, thus producing more GFP and making these lovely bright green worms. So what did we do with this reporter? Well, another thing Parisa did was this great genetic screen in C. elegans to identify factors required for no good decay. She spent a long time on this, but unfortunately for her, I'm going to breeze right through it. So what she did is we put this reporter into C. elegans, treated them with the mutagen EMS, waited a few generations, and then selected for GFP positive animals, indicating that no good decay is broken. From there, we sequenced and identified these mutations, and we found these five factors. What's interesting about these hits is these first four factors all have known links to no good decay in some way. But surprisingly, this last factor, CAPI6, has never had a prior recognized role in stalling or no good decay before. So this begs the question, what is CAPI6 and why is it required for no good decay? So let's talk about CAPI6 a little bit. CAPI6 is a transmembrane protein and a polyamine transporter, which I'll talk a lot more about later. And it has all these various domains that ultimately just help it go through the conformational changes needed to transport that substrate. But who cares about CAPI6? A lot of people do, because the most interesting thing about CAPI6 is actually its human homolog, ATP13A2, which is implicated in a variety of neurodegenerative diseases, including its one it's most well known for is its implication in a juvenile onset form of Parkinson's disease called Kupffer-Rotgeb syndrome. So what can CAPI6 actually teach us about no good decay? Well, based on the fact that CAPI6 came out of our no good decay screen, we know some aspect of the cellular environment is altered in these CAPI6 mutant animals, but we just don't know how. Now, dysfunctional no good decay is something that we know is different, but it actually might be a readout of something bigger that we don't understand yet. Thus, it's important we understand how is quality control actually being disrupted by CAPI6 loss. Now, due to CAPI6's human homologs linked to metabolism and human disease, if we can understand CAPI6's mechanism and quality control, this might help us answer bigger questions in the field, like do disease states disrupt quality control? But I want to highlight that my project is actually focused on this first question here about understanding the link between CAPI6 and no good decay. So through my talk, I have three big questions I'm going to go through. First, we have what is the scope of translational dysfunction in CAPI6 animals? How does CAPI6 affect the cellular response to ribosomal stalling? And are CAPI6's effects mediated by polyamines? And if so, how? So starting with this first question, I have two smaller questions, but for now, we're just going to focus on this first one. What kinds of stalling substrates does CAPI6 affect? So in our original screen, we pulled CAPI6 out using our rare ARG reporter. I was curious that if I changed some features of that substrate and caused different types of stalls, so changing maybe rarity of codon or the type of polybasic sequence, whether CAPI6 would still have an effect on that reporter. So that's exactly what I did, is I made two other versions of the reporter, a common ARG as I call it, where I just changed the rarity of the codon, and then a poly-lyse reporter in which I changed from arginines to lysines. Otherwise, this reporter is exactly the same as I talked about before and works the same way. So first, I actually wanted to show our rare arginine data. So ZNF598 here is our positive control. It's an important no-good decay factor I'll talk more about later. As you can see here, when we delete ZNF598, we get more GFP, indicating the pathway is being broken. And when we look at CAPI6, we see a similar, although reduced effect, but it's still breaking no good decay pretty significantly here. So we know that CAPI6 is affecting that reporter. Another thing I wanted to highlight is this is some RNA-seq data of our rare ARG reporter levels in CAPI6 and ZNF mutants. And as you can see here, with both of these mutants, we do actually see higher mRNA levels of our rare ARG reporter, telling us that the phenotype we see, so that GFP positive animal, it isn't just something like GFP aggregations, but that it's actually representative of higher mRNA levels, ultimately showing us that mRNA decay is actually compromised in CAPI6 animals. So moving on to those other reporters. Next, we're looking at our common ARG reporter, so changing the rarity of that codon. Once again, we have ZNF as our positive control here. You can see it's lost, breaks no good decay. And once again, when we look at CAPI6 here, it is also once again breaking no good decay. So this tells us that CAPI6 loss affects no good decay targets regardless of the arginine codon rarity that we used. Now, an interesting feature about our reporter that I haven't really talked about yet is this really fun thing to do with arginine-dependent stalls. So a bunch of arginines in a row look awfully similar to a nuclear localizing signal. So much so that it actually did act as a nuclear localizing signal. And we got these beautiful spotty worms with all these lovely little dots on them. This was really great for GFP quantification because it makes that really bright GFP that's just easy for us to quantify. However, when I made the polylysed reporter, it did not have that same luxury. For whatever reason, it decided to be cytoplasmic localized and was very, very dim here. And thus it's been really, really hard to quantify. So instead of using GFP to quantify these animals, moving forward, I actually decided to use a different secondary phenotype that our reporter has. So what is that phenotype of our reporter? Uncoordination or unkness. So another thing I didn't mention yet is that we made our reporter at this UNC54 locus, which encodes for a myosin protein that's expressed in the body wall muscle. Now, this is important to have good levels of so that your animal can move around, because when you have low levels of UNC54, you gain this uncoordination or UNC phenotype. So what does this look like? When you have UNC animals, they basically have almost a form of paralysis here, in which you can see they basically barely move around. They can like slowly wiggle. They're just not having a great time in that sense. Versus when we have non-UNC animals, they can freely move around and act like your normal worms. It's also worth noting that just like with GFP, this UNC phenotype is in fact a spectrum. So it's not just UNC or non-UNC, but it is actually a scale of UNCness that happens. So in regards to our reporter, the more non-UNC the animal, the more de-repressed our reporter is, and ultimately the more dysfunctional NOGA decay is. So moving on to that, how do I quantify UNCness? I did two different assays, but I'll talk about them one at a time. First, I did this swimming assay in which I take a worm, put it into liquid, and then I count the number of thrashes it does. Because if you are kind of paralyzed, you can't really wiggle back and forth very much. So this was my way of quantifying UNCness here. Looking at our polylice reporter data here, you can see once again, we have ZNF as our positive control and CAPI6 here, in which both of those mutants are less UNC because they were able to move around more, had more thrashes, and thus both of them are breaking NOGA decay with this reporter. Now, when I look at the second assay that I did, this brood size assay, this is another way I can quantify UNCness. So I isolate a worm, I let it lay as many eggs as possible, and then I count the number of offspring it produced. Because in order to give birth, you have to squeeze those muscles. So an UNC animal is not able to have a very high progeny size. So once again, we're looking at our polylice reporter, our ZNF mutant, and our CAPI6 mutant. And you can see that both of these do in fact make less UNC animals because they're able to have a higher progeny size and are breaking NOGA decay. So together, both these assays tell me that CAPI6 loss does affect other polybasic NOGA decay targets. So looking back at my big question here, what kinds of stalling substrates does CAPI6 affect? I saw that CAPI6 affects various types of NOGA decay substrates besides just our rare arginine reporter. Now moving to our second question here, does CAPI6 affect other translation-dependent mRNA decay pathways? So our lab studies three different quality control pathways, and they differ because they have different distinct triggers. So for NOGA decay, it's triggered by the ribosomal collision. In nonsense-mediated decay, we have a premature stop codon, and in nonsense decay, we have lack of a stop codon. Now, since NOGA decay is the only one that's collision dependent, I was curious to see if losing CAPI6 had an effect on these other pathways, as this might be able to give unique insight into what CAPI6 is actually doing in its mechanism. So to do this, I got a hold of a few reporters our labs used before. So we have this nonstop reporter, which as the name implies, was used to measure nonstop decay. And then we have two different nonsense mediated decay reporters, this R293 and this R2. They just differ in terms of one of them's just in the body wall muscle, while one of them is worm-wide. But don't worry too much about the details of how these reporters work, as I'll tell you the relevant phenotypes as we go through them. So first, starting with looking at nonstop decay, here we have two positive controls, SKI2 and NONU1, two factors important for that pathway. And in terms of phenotype, this works the same as our other no-go reporters. So more GFP means more broken the pathway. So you see that our two positive controls, when I break them, we get a broken nonstop decay. However, when we look at our CAPI6 delete, we see here that it didn't have an effect on our reporter. So this led me to conclude that CAPI6 is not affecting nonstop decay. Now, moving on to looking at nonsense mediated decay, we're first going to look at our R2 reporter. And I want you to just pay attention to this RFP channel here. So more RFP means more broken the pathway. SMUG1 here is going to be our positive control, in which you can see deletion of that factor makes a nice bright red worm. However, when we look at CAPI6, you can see that these animals are basically just as dim as our wild type and appear non-existent on the screen, but I swear they're a little bit. Then looking at our second reporter, our R293, this is also a UNC54 reporter. So we're going to be measuring a swimming assay and looking at number of thrashes. And so here you can see that when we delete smug one or positive control, we get way less on animals. But when we delete CAPP6, we see no effect on the reporter. So together, this information has led me to conclude that CAPP6 is not affecting nonsense mediated decay. So back to our question, does CAPP6 affect other translation dependent mRNA decay pathways? We see no effect of CAPP6 loss on nonstop decay in NMD reporters. Okay. So to our next question, how does CAPP6 affect the cellular response to ribosomal stalling? I have one big question here, which is what is the genetic relationship between CAPP6 and other no-go decay factors? So the basis for this question is that we pulled CAPP6 out of this screen with a bunch of other no-go decay factors, and those factors all have relationships to each other. So I was curious, okay, how is CAPP6 fitting into the puzzle with all these other factors that are all friends with each other? So to do this, I did a double mutant experiment in which I'll kind of describe it here with fake data. So first, we'll basically look at the effect of single mutants, so of our CAPP6 delete, and then a no-go decay factor of my choice. And this is all in the background of our rare arch reporter, which is that very first one I introduced at the start. So I look at the effect of those single mutants, and then I make a double mutant, so deleting both CAPP6 and that no-go decay factor, in which I could see one of three different outcomes. Outcome one is I could see this non-additive effect, meaning that the GFP of the double mutant is no brighter than the brightest single mutant. My second outcome could be I could see an additive effect in which the GFP of the double mutant is brighter than either single mutant. Or I could see a subtractive effect in which the double mutant is dimmer than the brightest single mutant. So what does a bunch of GFP tell me about the relationship between these factors? Well, if I see a non-additive or subtractive effect, this tells me that CAPP6 and that no-go decay factor have some form of dependency or are on pathway with each other. In contrast, if I see an additive effect, this tells me that CAPP6 and that other no-go decay factor are independent of each other or off pathway from each other. So moving on to actually looking at some, well, I guess not the data just yet, but the data that I'll talk to you about, I'm going to be just talking about CAPP6's relationship with ZNF598 today. I will be doing it with other no-go decay factors in the future, but for today, that's the only one I'm going to talk about. So all you need to know about this factor is that you have your ribosome collision happen, ZNF598 detects that collision, and then it leads to promote downstream mRNA decay. So what did that data actually look like? Well, this is going to get a little bit complex, so I'll try to go through it. Our lab's been a little bit stumped by it, so we'll work through it together. So first we have our CAPP6 delete here. You can see bright animals, broken no-go decay. Our ZNF delete here, once again, more broken no-go decay. But then interestingly, when we made our double mutant of CAPP6 and ZNF, we actually see that subtractive effect here. So we see the reduction in GFP. So what does the subtract effect actually mean here? This is telling us that loss of CAPP6 is reducing the effect of losing ZNF598. Because I have ZNF598 alone, very broken no-go decay. Then when suddenly I delete a second factor, it almost looks like no-go decay is somehow being rescued. But when we think about this further, this is telling me that CAPP6 is doing something to typically support ZNF598 function, but in a way that is not specific to just impacting ZNF598. So what I mean by that is that CAPP6 is not solely having an effect on ZNF's ability to do its job. Now, the reason I know it's not solely affecting ZNF is because if otherwise, this double mutant would be equally bright to the single mutant. Because you can imagine if CAPP6's only purpose was to either help or inhibit ZNF, then it would stay equally bright because removing a second factor, ZNF is already gone, so it wouldn't matter. But so that's why we know it's not solely affecting that. So ultimately, the big conclusion here is that this means that when both factors are gone, that it's not just ZNF being impacted, but some other aspect of no-go decay upstream is actually being impacted. So I'm going to try to put forward a model here that's consistent with this data, and I'll walk you through it, and hopefully it'll help clarify some of this a bit more. So based on our subtractive result, our best model of what CAPP6 is doing is this idea that it's helping translation in some way. So in a wild-type scenario, we have CAPP6 doing something to help promote translation, and we have ZNF available to detect those collisions and promote mRNA decay. So in this case, we have low mRNA levels because ZNF is going around degrading everything, and thus we're going to get low GFP. When we look at a ZNF mutant, CAPP6 is still there to promote translation, but ZNF is gone. No one's there to detect collisions and promote mRNA decay. So we have high stabilized mRNA levels and thus high GFP levels, which is what we see. When we look at a CAPP6 mutant, CAPP6 is gone and it's not there to help promote translation. So perhaps we have less ribosomes on our mRNA. and thus there's less collisions potentially happening. This means that if ZNF is going around looking for collisions to happen, it's maybe not finding as many of them, so it might be doing some mRNA decay, but not as much as it would do in a wild-type scenario. So for that reason, we get this kind of intermediate amount of GFP where it's more than the wild-type level. Now, when we look at our double mutant case, Capi-6 is gone, so we have reduced translation and less ribosomes here on our mRNA. ZNF isn't there, so it's not detecting any collisions anyways, so we have this kind of combination of a little bit more mRNA stability, but also because there's less ribosomes there, we have less translation of GFP. So we get this reduced level of GFP, hence why we would get a subtractive result for this double mutant outcome. So this begs the question of, okay, how is Capi-6 affecting translation then? So to get at this question, I wanted to take a look at two missense mutations that we pulled from that original genetic screen that I talked about and see what information they could give me. So those two missense mutations are G308R and A741V, which you can see here, both are breaking no-go decay because they're GFP positive, although varying amounts. Now I wanted to see if these missense mutations were doing anything to Capi-6's structure and if that could give me any insight of what they're doing. So as a reminder, Capi-6 is a polyamine transporter, and it does this by going through a series of conformational changes mediated by ATP binding, autophosphorylation, and dephosphorylation. So when I looked at the location of these missense mutations, I noticed that both of them were suspiciously close to catalytic sites of Capi-6. So G308R is part of this highly conserved TGES sequence, which is critical for the dephosphorylation step of that mechanism. And then A741V is close to this D476, which is the key residue in the autophosphorylation step of that mechanism. So due to the combined information of, I know these mutants are breaking no-go decay, and the fact that they have this proximity to catalytic sites that are important for polyamine transport, this led me to hypothesize that Capi-6 transport function is what is actually required for no-go decay. So perhaps what our model is this idea that Capi-6 is dysfunctional, there's no polyamines being transported, and it's actually about the lack of polyamines present in the cell that's causing our effect on no-go decay. So how could polyamines be affecting the cellular environment? Well, loss of polyamines could be doing a few things. One idea is this idea of causing increased oxidative stress. As one important role that polyamines have is that they sequester reactive oxidative species in the cell. So if you don't have enough polyamines to manage those ROS, you're going to have an increase in cellular stress, which could cause a variety of problems throughout the cell. Another idea is that we could have loss of hypocyanated EIF5A. So EIF5A is an important translation factor that helps manage ribosomal pauses during elongation. And the key thing about it is that it actually requires the polyamine spermidine for its maturation and function. So if you don't have polyamines available, EI5A might not be matured. And if it's not matured, it's not there to help with translational pauses. Another idea is that there might be less free polyamines to bind to ribosomes. So polyamines are known to bind to the ribosomes to provide structure stability. In E. coli cells, about 12 to 15% of polyamines are stably associated with ribosomes. So if we don't have enough polyamines, it could cause a significant impact on ribosome stability or translation fidelity. So these are all directions that I still need to explore. I have experiments designed for them, but I don't have time to talk about that today. But I'm also very eager to hear other ideas from the crowd about ways that you might know polyamines to affect things like translation or quality control. So moving forward, kind of to my third big question, are Capi-6's effects mediated by polyamines? And if so, how? I kind of want to go into these three big questions about looking at, do reduced polyamine levels, oxidative stress, or EI5A, are any of them capable of affecting no-go decay? But that's all future work. So I want to thank everyone for listening to my talk. I want to thank the Airbrain Lab, especially Parisa, for all of her early work she did in setting up this project. Of course, the Microscopy Center with Ben, because I took so many worm images, and of course, our funding. So thank you, and any questions? Yeah.
Okay. So you have the polylysine sequence that stalling from a rare?
No.
Or different?
So that's just stalling just based off of a polybasic sequence. So they're like the average codon. Yeah.
Okay. Because what I'm wondering is, it's like a very slippery sequence.
Mm.
And I know that polyamines have a pretty big effect on transcription. I'm wondering if that would rescue it if it slipped and was producing, like, instead of AAG, like AGA, different amino acid. Because I remember Parisa looked at the arginine reading frame. I'm wondering if there's
Yeah, we haven't done that analysis with these other two reporters, not the common ARGE or the polylice, but like you said, Priest has looked at whether frame shifting is happening with our rare ARGE reporter. And based off that data, we didn't see it with those. So it could potentially be different with these other ones, but for most of our stuff, we've been still trying to figure it out, just focused on the rare ARGE reporter. So at least with that one, we haven't been seeing any frame shifting.
Because I haven't fully thought about it, but yeah. I don't know if it makes sense because polyamine is supposed to raise the amount of frame shifting exactly.
Yeah, still worth explaining it. Yeah, could still be worth looking into. Yeah, yeah. So many hands. Okay.
Yeah. If you did when you did the swimming assay, you know, Did you age match your worm and like what age
were they? Yeah. These were all staged together to the same age, and I had them staged at L4s. Yeah. Lena, yeah.
Great talk, really, really great talk. Thanks also for this mental image I have now in my head, the worm pushing out progeny of a woman.
It's exactly, yeah.
Such a
good
anyway, that was weird. So I was just wondering, because you figured out that CAT-P6 is probably only affecting no-go, but not non-stop and nonsense. So is it common for factors that affect no-go, for example, to also affect the other? Like, how common is it typically or not at all?
I guess I don't know how to say it in terms of commonness, but I will say there is factors between these pathways that do overlap. So for example, that factor Nonu1 that I mentioned is actually a key factor also in no-go decay. So that's why it was especially interesting to do that experiment is like, hey, these factors have shared features to some degree. Like they do have unique aspects, but they also have shared ones. So like if it wasn't affecting one of them, which it ended up being, that tells me some insight about, well, it's not affecting some of those shared factors in some way.
Right. Yeah. I don't really know that much about these. I have to straight up admit, don't know that much about nonsense and all these, but it just seems interesting to me that it only affects no-go.
Yeah, we're partially thinking that's why the like collision model or the like reduced translation, reduced collisions might make sense, is because that's something that the collisions are unique to no-go. So like, yeah. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, you had mentioned that the two different reporters you made with the common ARGEs and the ICs would create like different stalls. Like how are they expected to differ from each other?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is, I don't think we exactly know in terms of, we've shown now that the key, so ZNF598 is kind of like our staple no-go factor. Like at least for me, I define no-go as if it's affected by ZNF, it's a no-go like target. And so the fact that ZNF is affecting all of them tells me that at the very least, it's going through the same no-go. I don't know exactly what that means in terms of maybe they could be some different conformation of ribosomes perhaps, but at the very least, it's the same category enough where ZNF is able to detect it. So I guess that's as much as I can kind of say on that topic.
Yes.
Nah. Yeah.
Just a question. For the CAT-P6 mutants, was it shown that they did have less ribosomes, or is that something you guys are hypothesizing?
Yeah, we have not tested it yet, but that is something that I want to do, is actually see, well, yeah, are there less ribosomes on these mRNAs or on our reporter? Yeah, sure.
So I feel like you did a great job touching on the first two questions that you posed in the beginning. The last one, which is like, why?
Yeah.
You didn't really get there. And so I was curious, if you thought about why in the terms of, you know, specialized ribosomes that are not properly assembled, or if you're talking about environmental stressors and things like that, you know, how much of this comes down to, you know, when you've got ribosomes that aren't the same, you know, trying to translate the same message and then encounter each other. Is that something where you think there can be a role for?
Yeah.
Nobody came? Or do you think that the specialized ribosomes is like kind of BS? Like I'm
interesting
people sort of like, well, that's a big
process.
So I mean, I'm kind of curious, like, have you thought about having specialization? How does that factor in?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about the question of like, why does no-go decay exist like too much? So it's definitely been stuff on my mind. I would say like the biggest way I've been leaning is more towards like, I mean, we have lots of different models in the lab of like things it could be. And unfortunately, we're not super close to that answer just yet. I think one of the models that really interests me in terms of it isn't necessarily about specialized ribosomes, but this idea that like kind of going back to that environmental triggers question, that like, if there's something wrong in the cell, you have disruptions in homeostasis, or you have a disease state happening, that potentially things like that, where something's wrong in the cell, there's chaos happening everywhere. And that's what kind of can trigger these stalls and collisions. And that's when no-go decay comes in. And that's why we haven't found a target, maybe, is like, it's not happening all the time, but when things go bad, it's kicked into action. So that's at least my thoughts on it, but still a lot to figure out. Yeah.
So you're hypothesizing that maybe where there's less less translation, mm-hmm. but then what if that is actually more turnover? So more protein turnover.
More protein.
More turnover. And then that wouldn't explain the like decay protein type.
Yeah.
But if the depletion does just two separate effects, more turnover, and then separately a no-go effect.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that also give like the fact that the GSP went down a little bit compared to resonant activation?
Yeah, so that we have, you're saying reduce mRNA levels and protein levels, or just one or the other? Yeah, I mean, like we looked at the mRNA a little bit, and remember with the original RNA-seq, we saw that stabilized mRNA levels, but we haven't really done like, I guess, exactly a quantification of like protein levels per se, in terms of like, it could be that we have regular mRNA levels. And so that's why we see that increased GFP, but maybe the actual protein itself might be being degraded at a different rate. I haven't really thought of that yet. So a good idea of stuff to look into, but yeah. Yeah.
One last.
No worries.
So this like came up. I sat in on like Parisa's practice thesis talk. Then at the thesis talk, someone brought this up.
Yeah.
And now I'm wondering about this. So like mm-hmm. you guys identified the CATP6.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Parisa. You're the ones that had suggested the homologs involved in neurodegenerative disease.
No. So that's something that's well recognized in literature, is that ATP1-3A2. Yeah, yeah.
So you guys should totally make model like because if you're yeah. missing the endogenous targets because it's not in the proper disease state, and you know there's implications with this guy in neurodegenerative disease,
like
you
put know, our worms in a disease state
something, then maybe you'll catch some endogenous targets.
Yeah, I would love to do something like that. And I think also on the opposite end, there's not literature showing that ATP1-3A2 has an effect on stalling. So like, that's kind of the flip side of the coin of like, well, would a disease state cause, you know, broken no-go here? Or does loss of ATP1-3A2 cause broken stalling in humans, you know? So there's like work on both ends, but I would love to look into it. Yeah, Al?
It's been a while since I thought cell biology, but one thing we talked about was mechanisms of pausing and bringing the ribosomes to the ER for translation, and then you'd have to pause to allow things to go through, but also release them. I'm wondering, because the way the reporters are designed, they're all soluble cytoplasmic proteins
mm-hmm.
or nuclear localized eventually. But I'm wondering if maybe the native no-go may be involved in, you know, in dealing with mRNAs whose ribosomes whose ability to translocate is somehow messed up.
Oh.
They're stuck and paused at the ER surface, but unable to do translocation steps. And I'm wondering if some of the substrates you build miss that.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I haven't really thought about that too much, but that's an interesting idea that like it's just not getting to the place where no-go is actually happening at or something. And so that's why it looks increased. I think that was something that I Parisa possibly thought about at one point, but yeah, that's really good. I like that. Nat, yeah.
Related to the disease states,
mm-hmm.
thing. So on the flip side, I guess no one's linked the no-go decay to this age.
Yeah.
But has anyone shown that disease state causes activation of no-go decay?
So that's a bit more complex of a question. The answer is yes and no. Yes, in the sense of people have linked sort of disruption or like disease states to disruptions in quality control. So like in mice, it's been seen that losing factors, not in no-go, but in a sister pathway that's involved in the nascent chain degradation, that loss of a key factor there causes a neurodegenerative phenotype. But I think the reason that I say no is because ATP 1382 has been the only no-go factor that we've now identified, including that, that has ever come out in like a GWAS screen, so a genome-wide association study. So in humans with disease phenotypes, ATP 1382 has been the only one actually linked. So that's why I give it a answer to it.
Let's thank Chloe.
Hi, Zoom. Oh, can I close Zoom or do I need to? Okay.